Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Amy and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the Nava Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based upon the pages from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story is described in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Okay. Tonight, this speaker is very special to me. She's my sponsor. She's my friend, and she's always got a positive outlook. So I give you Julie.
Hey, everybody, I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. I hope that my story will help somebody in the room tonight if you're struggling with whether you are an alcoholic or whether you want to get sober or not. We tell our stories so that we can identify with each other in the rooms. And unfortunately, we have preconceived notions of people based on what they look like and who they are, and we can't help that. So I know there's a few people in the room thinking right now, what the hell can my mother tell me about AA and alcoholism? But I wasn't this old when I came in, so I'll just say it like that. I'd like to start off my story by giving you the details so that you don't do the math while I'm talking. I'll try to figure it out for you. I was born May 23rd, 1961, which makes me 55 years old. And I had my first drink my freshman year in college when I was 18. And I drank until February 25th, 1995. So, the good Lord willing, by February I'll have 22 years of sobriety, which is nothing more than a whole lot of days strung in together. I think those are the facts. Those are mathematical facts there. But so going back to this idea that we tell our stories to identify, if you can't identify with what I look like or even what I sound like, I just want to read something to you, because for me, I call this portion of the Big Book, you know, our great equalizer. It's the thing that we can all agree on. And it goes like this. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. For me, this is our great equalizer. If you are an unhappy drinker, you understood that page. I was an unhappy drinker. That is exactly where I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Waking up every day bewildered and frustrated and afraid and in despair that I could not stop drinking, that I would say to myself I wouldn't drink again, and then I would. That's where I was. I came in here and that's what happened. That's where I was. But then I did the things that people told me to do. Took the steps. I'm not going to get into the semantics. A lot of old timers will take you to the mat on that stuff. Not me. And I got the promises that we read about in the ninth step. I'm trying to find the promises that I'm looking for. But I also got this. I went from that shivering denizen of King Alcohol to this because of the program behind me. And it goes like this. It's after it's the tenth step promises. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we would quarrel from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So yes, I went from that shivering person to somebody who never thinks about alcohol at all. And I'll give you a story to prove that to you. A few months ago, some people were going to come over. It was the weekend, and some people were going to come over. So I thought, well, I better go up to Kroger and buy some beer for them. So I go up to Kroger, I get the beer, a couple other things I was going to get. I go to check out, and the clerk looks at me, and she says, 12:30. I'm like, what? She said, it was 11:30. It was a Sunday. She said, you can't buy that till 12:30. I'm like, oh. And just the revelation that I didn't know exactly what time that alcohol would be served or given to me is so amazing to me. You know, it's just totally amazing to me. And that is what they mean by that. Cease fighting it, cease knowing anything, cease caring about anything, you know, about alcohol. Cease fighting alcohol. Don't even think about it. So it was quite funny. I felt really excited about that. Those are the small things in life that get you excited, I guess. All right, but let me tell you how I got there. I am the last of six children. I'm the baby. And my family is riddled with alcoholism. My grandmother convinced the doctor that she needed champagne for medical reasons so she could write it off her taxes. That's how she drank. And so, you know, and my mother was one of us, and she never got into the grooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She died of this disease, and it is, I promise you, a very, very ugly way to die. My mother was a very beautiful woman, and she was not in the end, and that's very memorable for me. My father, I would say, probably was, had some hell of a willpower, could stop drinking when he wanted to, but he pretty much always shifted back to it. You know, it's in my family. I have a sister who's here. I'm very excited to say she's going to celebrate 3 years in November, and that is a miracle, a gift from God, because I sure thought that would never happen. But again, I never thought I would ever get sober either. So I grew up, I actually had a pretty good childhood. I was born in Memphis, and you know, it was fun. It was this, you know, just that time that we all, you know, see movies about. They're called nostalgia. It was my childhood. And being the baby, I kind of guess I got what I wanted when I wanted it. And I was pretty good at manipulating my father into giving me what I wanted. But he insisted that there were four girls and a boy. And then my older brother died in infancy, so I did not know him. And you know, we lived in Memphis. We moved to Tampa when I was 11 years old. 11 was, you know, that was puberty. That was not a real good time for me. I kind of looked like a giant cucumber, and I sounded like a hick from Memphis, and I moved to Tampa, and all these cool kids were there, and yeah, it just wasn't fun for a while. But like you'll hear in this room, I just didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't feel like I fit into my family. I didn't feel like I fit into my friends, into my world, you know, even as a young child. And I became very rigid, I guess you would say. I'm always sort of been the glass half empty person. And I don't know how I got that way, and it doesn't really matter, but from an early age, I always thought the worst was going to happen, and could not see the positivity in anything. One time when I was about 12, my sister, who's now in the program, and she's 7 years older than I am, were walking through the parking lot of a strip mall in Tampa, and this giant flock of birds flew by. And she stopped, and she looked up, and she was like, "Wow, yeah, that's beautiful." I'm 12. I look up, and I say, "Oh, great, we're going to get shit on." You know, and she just looked at me like, "What? How did you come up with, you know?" And it was true. I don't know how a 12-year-old gets like that. It doesn't really matter. I just have to admit that I am like that, right, so that I can fix stuff like that. So, you know, I grew up, I had friends. I guess I was popular. I didn't really feel popular, but, a lot of us, we didn't feel like what we were on the outside. In high school, I could tell what was going on with alcohol in my family, so I became very negative about, well, I was negative about everything, but I was very negative about alcohol. And I sort of became sort of the Carrie Nation of my high school. You can go to Google and figure out who Carrie Nation is, but she was big in the temperance movement. And I just thought, you know, anybody who drank was an idiot, and I saw what it was doing to my family. I was the daughter who, when they would give you those pamphlets in PE about health and alcohol, I would leave them on the kitchen floor for my mother each night as she was sitting there drinking and smoking and watching TV, as if she was going to care, you know. But every morning they'd be gone, and they wouldn't be on the counter. They were gone. So I don't know if she thought I was being clever or just what, but... So I just graduated from high school feeling like, you know, alcohol was very, very bad, and very, you know, I was morally against it, absolutely morally against it. Got into college. I went into the University of Florida. Get it out of your system now. If you want to boo, go ahead, boo. I don't care. Just get it out of your system. I hear it all the time. I live in Georgia. You know, there's a lot of alcohol and other things at the University of Florida. And I was a freshman, and I was in my dorm, and we were all going to go out. And my friend Andy Murray Garrity showed up in my dorm room with some vodka and orange juice and said, "You're having a drink." And I drank it. And I am one of the people that you hear about in this room all the time. I remember every moment of that. And I felt as if I was a whole different person. I felt finally like my skin fit, that I was funny, that I could be laugh with and not at, and that I was just bigger than I thought I ever was. And I was just comfortable, and it was just an awe moment, you know, just relaxing. I have pictures from that night. And I drank alcoholically from the get-go. I really did. And so for me, that proves to me, we talk about it a lot in here, that alcoholism is hereditary, and that we're born with it. Because the minute before I took that drink, I was morally opposed to alcohol. And after I took it, I was all about it. And so you can't go like from that to that. You can't just change your moral behavior like that. It happened to me physically. It happened to me instantly. And, about the next time I went home, Tampa's about a couple hours from Gainesville, I was fixing this drink. And my mother was so freaking relieved. You know, she's like, didn't have Carrie Nation in her house anymore telling her how to drink and how to be. And I finally felt like I was part of my family. You know, I was finally part of the dinner conversation where I got to not just be the one crying, but I got to make people cry. Because that's what we did in my family. He who cries last wins. So I went to the University of Florida. I did drink. I didn't drink every day. I did very well in the University of Florida. I joined a sorority. I was in a fraternity, or a little sister at a fraternity. Had all the escapades you can imagine in high school, in college, with drinking. I remember we had a bit. I was an SAE little sister, and that's the fraternity that's getting kicked off of like every campus in America now for their bad behavior. But they would have these parties for the girls in the school, and they would fill garbage cans with grain alcohol and punch, like those size garbage cans, and you can't really taste it. So one night I was drinking it, and I kept drinking it, and I kept going back. And you know, my friend, who was the brother there, he said, "You know, Julie, there really is alcohol in that." You know, which was so funny because the reason they did it was to not let the girl. They didn't want the girls to know there was alcohol. But I was drinking so much of it, even like, "You need to know there's alcohol in that." You know, so it got to by the end of the night, I literally was dipping my cup in so far that I was going up to my elbow. I mean, I was just trying to drink the whole thing. And my arm was purple. I'm not kidding. I had a purple arm. And it was a rough night, I can tell you that. But it didn't stop me, you know. Made a fool out of myself. Did all the things that you just wish you had never done in your life, but it did not stop me. It just kept getting worse. So graduated from the University of Florida and got a job and moved back down to my parents moved to Atlanta my senior year of college, and so I moved back down here or down to Tampa because that's really kind of for me where I was from. Atlanta was not part of my life, and got a corporate job, started being the good corporate doobie, was on the fast track because you could drink with the guys, you know, back then, and it was okay. My friends, we all had a good time. I saw everybody was drinking like I was, but they really weren't. You know, they were going to happy hour, and I was going to happy hour hours, you know. Eventually, they all started, you know, getting boyfriends who, like, actually asked them to get married and start a life with like an adult would. And I wasn't. I was just working and drinking. I got to that point where, you know, a lot of the stuff I was doing was pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. A lot of it. You know, stalled my career. I was on the fast track, but not quickly stalled my career because, you know, the corporate guys like to drink with corporate guys, and they think it's kind of funny to drink with the women, but eventually the women blow that deal. Like, not anymore. That's more than we want the women to drink. We just want you to be cute for a while. We don't want you to be hideous, you know. So I blew my career, you know. I couldn't be part of the fast track anymore. I was drinking to blackout every night, either by myself and, you know, I was driving drunk. One night I picked up a guy in a bar and fell all the way down the wooden steps. All the way down, from the top all the way to the bottom, backward, and it hurt a lot. It's not like the movies, you know. It just hurts. But you know, I guess there was a good thing I was drunk, because I'd probably be dead if I weren't, you know. Because I hear you're supposed to relax when you fall like the Evel Knievel stunt thing, so I thought it was. But let's see, what else happened to me? But it was pretty bad, and I found a man to marry me, bless his heart, and we got married, and I was still drinking. And, you know, one time I heard a woman talk about getting sober really young. You know, I was 33 when I got sober, and I heard a woman talking about getting not wanting to quit drinking really young because she wouldn't be able to drink at her wedding, you know. And when she said that, I thought back to my wedding and how alcohol controlled my wedding, because it was a 7 o'clock wedding, and all I could think about was how I can't drink until the reception, and how it just ruined my wedding, because I was consumed by alcohol by then. Whether I was drinking it or not drinking it, it was every moment of my life. I was functioning, y'all. I had the stuff. I had the man. Look at that, you know? But no, I was ruled. I was a citizen of King Alcohol. That's what Denison means. And I didn't know it, you know. I still thought I was cool, hip, and slick. And eventually it just got to where I didn't want to really go out anymore, and I was pre-drinking. If we went out, I would slam glass, a couple glasses of wine as fast as I could before. Now, oh wait, I left something in the apartment. I got to go get it, you know, to run back and pound a glass of wine. I mean, I remember going down the stairs of the apartment with the wine still sort of stuck in my throat, you know, like, how am I going to get this, all of this in my mouth like a chipmunk swallowed before I get to the car? And, you know, and then one, I just kept waking up every day. I was sick every day. I didn't want to go to work. I had to go to work. You know, how many times a week can you claim you have a stomach flu? You know, three is probably too many. But weekly I did that. And so one day I woke up and I just felt terrible, and my husband was yelling at me, and I remember thinking, oh God, help me, you know, just ugh. So I went, I had a terrible day, but I had an appointment with my psychiatrist that afternoon. And I've seen a psychiatrist for depression. I was drinking massive doses of a depressant every night, so it was no wonder that I was depressed, right? And so for some reason that day, I just looked at her, I said, I'm an alcoholic. Boom. And the light went off over her head, and she said, "We, really beautiful voice, I'll never forget it. You'd like to get some help for that, wouldn't you?" And that was like, oh, whoa, why did I tell her that? That's not what, no, you didn't, that's not what I meant, you know. And I just burst into tears and said, yeah, I guess, you know. So I went back the next month, and she said she didn't know much about it. She would ask her colleagues, and the next week I went back, and she said, here's a place called Ridgeview, and you should go. And am I sober yet? What time is that?
8:30.
Oh, I got to get sober. I'm starting to get sober. So I went to Ridgeview. I won't tell you how that's insane I am, but I actually made an appointment to check into Ridgeview. I thought I was checking into, like, I thought you had to make a reservation, like a hotel. And I went and I took their exam, and she's like, yeah, you should be here. I go, okay, well, I'll be back on February 25th. It's a Saturday. I have to take some more time off of work. And she's looking at me. She's like, yeah, right, okay. But I did, y'all. I mean, that's how determined, I'm a determined human being. And I knew I wanted to, I thought it was a spa. I didn't know what I was going to, you guys. I just knew I was having a real problem with alcohol. And this was what my psychiatrist said I should go do. So I packed up my perfume and my razor and all this stuff. I go into Ridgeview, the door's locked behind me. They grab my bags, they pull out my razor, my shampoo and my perfume, and they're like, we're taking this from you. I'm like, oh my God, you're taking my perfume? And then I realized, man, people must drink that stuff, you know? And some lawyer probably told them to take it away from everybody. And I was like, wow, what have I done, you know? But I'm really, really glad I did it. Because I was locked in there for 4 days and given a big book, soft cover, big book. That was $40,000 soft cover big book. I really thought they should have given me a hard cover for that. But and I am still a little resentful about that. So I don't know, maybe I have work to do. I have some work to do. But, you know, they introduced me to the program at Alcoholics Anonymous in a very expensive way. And I got my first white chip in Ridgeview, at a meeting at Ridgeview. And honestly, did not even know I was in an AA meeting. I just was going along with the crowd. I mean, they said, you know, we were going to meetings during the day. They were really kind of, you know, therapy sessions or whatever. And then there was this meeting, and they said white chip, and the people that I had just like checked into my hotel with were going up there. So I did too. And that's how I got my white chip, and it's the only one I have. Because the second or third day in this soft cover big book, I started reading it, and I got to the third step prayer, and it said, "Relieve me from the bondage of myself." And I had a white light experience, you guys. I came in. I was not a religious person. I don't think I was an atheist. I just thought you were pretty much stupid if you believed in a higher power or a God or anybody with a name, you know, any of the named gods. I just thought that was stupid. I just thought you had to be weak and immature and backward and a whole bunch of other stuff to believe that. But I read that sentence, "Relieve me from the bondage of myself." And I had the exact same sensation come over me that I had when I had that very first drink. My skin did again. just a little bit more than it did. I felt everything is going to be okay. Just like I did when I had that first drink. It's all going to be okay. So what happened to me, I guess, is one of the white light experiences. Not everybody has them. And I have to be reminded about my higher power a lot. It's not like I became Mother Teresa, you know, because I read that sentence. What happened to me is I had this overwhelming sense that it was going to be okay. So I kept reading. I kept doing what they were said to do. And then I came out. I got out of Ridgeview, and I went to the 9:30 meeting. My very first AA meeting outside of Ridgeview was the 9:30, which meets every day, Monday through Saturday, which is a fabulous, fabulous meeting. And thank God that they were a literature-based meeting, because we didn't get into the crap about, you know, who stole my bologna and stuff like that. We talked about the steps, and there was some really good sobriety in there, and they put up with me, and they let me be who I was, which was confused and angry and cocky and all the things that, you know, we are in early sobriety when we think we did it for ourselves, you know? So I was all the way up to third step, you know, and then one day I was confused, because I thought, well, I never really took the second step, because I'm smart. I jumped right to the third step right there in the second day of treatment. And I was in the 545, and Jim was probably there. He put up with the early days of my sobriety. And I was going on and on about how I had gotten myself sober, and I had gotten my appointment at Ridgeview, and I had figured it out, and I told my psychiatrist, and I checked myself in, and I'm coming to AA meetings, and I'm doing this. And then all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, that day that you told your psychiatrist you were an alcoholic, that morning you rolled over in bed and you said to yourself, God help me. Oh yeah, you did do that. Then I realized there is a higher power that did this for me, not Julie. Julie didn't do this. I came to believe power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't know I'd done it. I called out, and he heard me. I don't know what the psychic change really is, but a woman in this program once described it as when the grace meets the clarity. Grace is always there. The clarity is not always there. And I just got clear like that. Not all of us do that. I pray that you do, but, you know, it comes to us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So I had all this knowledge about myself of being this hot stuff in AA, and but I resisted the fourth step. Imagine that. Who resists the fourth step? And I got to almost a year in sobriety, and I thought, well, I'm such a good student, and I'm so fabulous at everything. Maybe I need to take the fourth step, because it would be really bad to get a whole year and still not have done your fourth step. Oh, I forgot to tell you about my sponsor. I can't get in trouble for going over. I found my sponsor by, when I told you that I was married when I came into the program, and I was a newlywed, and right after I got out of Ridgeview, we went out to dinner for the first time to go to a restaurant. And we walked into the Chili's over here at Toco Hill. And I was the person that loved to wait for the table, because then you could go to the bar and drink. Because I'd already pounded three or four at home on the way down the stairs, as you remember. And then get to the bar and drink some more, and then get to the table and drink some more. And somehow you think magically that nobody's counted any of those. When we walk in, and there was a wait, and the hostess says, okay, well, that would be about 5 minutes. Would you like to go to the bar? And I'm like, no. So we sat down in that little wooden bench, like outside the principal's office, right there in the foyer of the restaurant, you know. And I'm sitting there, and I look in the bar, and I just burst into tears, because I was like, what have I done? I'm not going in there again. And the hostess is looking at me like, geez, it's only 5 minutes. You don't have to cry about it. No reason to cry about it. My husband's like, you want to leave? And I'm like, no, I got to go to restaurants. I got to be able to go to a restaurant. And I did. And I don't remember much of it after that. But, I mean, I just remember that very, very clearly. Anyway, I went to a meeting at Ridgeview later, and I told that story. And the woman you know, responded. She crosstalked, which I'm supposed to do. And she said, well, no wonder you lost your best friend. And she just seemed to get it. She seemed to understand me, so I asked her afterwards to be my sponsor, and I'm so glad that I did. So when it came time for me to do my fourth step, I bitched and moaned about it. I complained. I had every excuse in the world, including, I promise you, that I could not make columns in Microsoft Word. Therefore, I could not do a fourth step because it had to be in columns. Didn't know how to do that. And I used that one for months. I can't believe Jim doesn't even remember that one. But I did. Finally, I bitched about it enough that Donald said, Donald Siegel said, look, just get a piece of paper and write God help me at the top of it and start writing. Okay, so I did. And I got all the information about myself down, so I thought, and my first fourth step was a searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me. You know? And here I was trying to do it before a year so I could get an A+, and it was going to be great. But, you know, it really wasn't. It was more like an F, you know, can't follow directions. But the cool thing about the fourth step is there's no way to get it. It's not graded. It is whatever it is. Whatever you can get on the paper is what's supposed to be on the paper. It just is. And thank God I did it that way, because after I did my fifth step and I went to this beautiful woman's beautiful condo and sat in her solid white living room, which I was still confused about. I'm like, how do you do that? And I don't remember that. It was just so white in there. And told her this stuff, but like really, I was still so angry, y'all. Even after a year, I wasn't drinking, but I had no real solution for who I was or how I was, how abrasive I was with society and the people around me. And so I just like all over, you know, like, hey, that bitch this and that thing, and he's a jerk, and blah, blah, blah. And the end of it, she just sweetly looked up and she said, my, what a sad, angry, lonely little girl you are. And I was like, the book says I'm singing from the mountaintop at this point, and you know, I don't, you know, no. Breeze through my hair, or whatever it says in the fifth step. No, I couldn't believe it. But then I realized, wow, that's the best piece of information anybody's ever given me. That's somebody who loved me enough to tell me the truth. Because trust me, my mouth was so acidic, people were not going to tell me the truth. They just weren't, you know? And I'm so grateful to have that sentence and that information so that I could go and do something about it. I could start working on how I was, you know? And so I did. I started working on how I was, and I got a little bit better, and let's see. Stalled out a little bit on that, on the steps, because I started having babies. I have a couple of beautiful babies. They're AA babies. They've never seen their mother drunk. My daughter will be 20 in January, and my son is 18. And are you allowed to call your own children beautiful? I am going to. My children are beautiful. They're smart. They're great. They're the best. Nanny boo boo. At least the jury is still out, I think, on them and the alcoholism, but please, y'all, be here in case they need you. So then I started getting back into the steps again, and I did another four step, and I got some really good information about myself, and I went to the 9:30, and I said, okay, I have all this information about myself, but what do? How do I stop doing this stuff, that these character defects? How do I stop? Do I just stop? Do I just stop doing these things? And all their heads were like nodding, yeah, you just stop. To stop. I'm like, oh, that's too hard. But I remember Paul McGee said that you can change, and that he suggests changing things a little at a time to prove to yourself that you can change. And I love this advice. He says, you know, move your watch to the other arm. I'm like, ooh, okay, well, okay, maybe that's possible. And then he says, you know, change shampoos or change your toothpaste. When he said that, in my head, I'm like, oh, hell no, I'm not changing my toothpaste. And then I realized, you know, you may be talking, he's talking to me. This is the behavior he's talking about. This is the inflexibility, the unwillingness to see, you know, that, you know, you can change the way you are and how you are. So I, that night, one of my character defects is controlling behavior. Imagine that. And but I like things to be okay and right. So I'm the kind of person that if my tag is showing or if I have like something in my teeth, I want you to tell me. I don't want to walk around like that. But my husband was the kind of person that didn't like that. He didn't like to be picked at like that, right? So that night, after I swore I was going to just stop doing my character defects, we had dinner, and I looked up at my husband, and he had salad dressing on his face right there. And I swear to God, I started sweating. I had to go to the laundry room and say the serenity prayer about the salad dressing on his face. Did not tell him or not reach over and fix it, you know, which is what I really wanted to do. So I was so proud of myself that I didn't do that. And I came back the next day to the 9:30 to report my progress in the sixth step, you know, humbly asking God to remove my shortcomings. They were very proud of me. You know, it's a little baby step. I have not fixed that character defect, y'all. Sorry, but I tried to start with the hardest one first. It didn't work. But what I have found through my step work, and, you know, I've been sober longer than I drank. By a lot now, actually. So, for me, the growth of the program comes with learning more and more about myself and what I'm capable of doing well and what I'm capable of doing not so well. And for me, 6 and 7 are the best part of the steps because that's where I'm willing to look at myself and willing to admit it and own it and then maybe do something about it. And I can own it as long as I want. And the 12 and 12 talks about that. It talks about, you know, until we were humbled by alcohol, we couldn't get sober. And it says, until we're humbled by our character defects, we're not going to do anything about them either. And it says, for us, the process of gaining a new perspective was unbelievably painful. Does that sound fun? No. But I can tell you something. Each time I did better, I felt closer to my higher power. Each time I felt a spiritual experience. Each time I did something better and different, it was a spiritual experience. And it was like seeing a color I'd never seen before, and I just wanted to see it again. So I wanted to do better and better. You know, and this is difficult. You know, some of us don't have... I mean, I thought I was perfect, you know? I mean, I wasn't a thief. I never opened up a cash drawer and took money out of it. I didn't steal anything from anybody. I didn't have any of those kind of behaviors, right? But we have behaviors that are so pervasive in our characters, you know, and entitlements and things like that. I mean, when I was out there drinking, I had a roommate. Jeez, I'm here. And she and I went to Target. We had a brand new apartment. We had this beautiful, beautiful patio, right? And we went to Target to buy furniture for it. This was when I was single, young, with it, up and comer in Tampa, just before the fall off the cliff. And we go to Target, and the woman is scanning the chairs, but she doesn't scan the cushions, right? So my roommate and I, both employed, both able to pay for the cushions, are looking at each other. And they're like, oh, I'm not going to say anything. And we get out to the parking lot. We're in the parking lot singing, free cushion day at Target, free cushion day at Target. And, you know, there's a word for that kind of behavior. It's called shoplifting. But I never, until I got into this program, would have put that together. You don't do that. That's just ridiculous. But I did. So me telling myself I didn't have any of these character defects, oh, you come in this program and start getting closer to them and you will see them. You know, you will really see them. And God has a good sense of humor, and he'll give you opportunities to fix them. He really will. And lots of mine, you know, I've had to be kind of beaten into submission with some of my character defects. And they're not always gone. But, you know, this is the part of the program that separates the men from the boys, as our book says. And there's no reason, in my opinion, to do a fourth and fifth step and gather this information about yourself if you're not willing to do something about the bad stuff or the stuff that's keeping you from a spiritual life or a better life. Because it's just going to be miserable. For me to walk around knowing that I was a sad, angry, lonely little girl and not do anything about it, you know, or try to work on some of these other defects, continue to take things from the store that weren't mine, you know, because somebody made a mistake. And that's for me, you know, I tell my sponsees, you know, if you love your victimhood, if you still love your victimhood, do not take a 6 and 7 step, because you're going to have to own up to your own behavior. You know, and that's what I had to do, own up to my own behavior. Step 8 is, you know, some people say to just take your whole 4th step and put it into your 8th step, but I don't really think that's true. I made my list, and I have found that because my memory is faulty, I think of people still, you know. I'll be listening to the 80s channel, and the music brings back memories of things and people. So after I had my 8th step list done, I started my 9th step. And I can tell you that is when I really started to feel comfortable in my own skin. And I don't advise you to wait as long as I did. I might have spent 4 or 5 years into sobriety before I was doing this completely, you know, really doing it. But I've done every kind of a 9th step you can do, except for the gravesite one. I haven't needed to do a gravesite amends. But I have written letters, and I've phoned people, and I've face-to-face apologized to people. I've apologized for things that seem silly. I've apologized to things that really needed to be, you know, done to fix a relationship. And I have amended a lot of my relationships. I will tell you that I have a lot of sisters, as I said, and I have one. This program is great, because when I came into this program, I called her the sister from hell. Right? That was really nice, right? The sister from hell. But now she's just the sister from Houston. So progress, not perfection, right? Progress. But I was probably 5 years sober, and God spoke to me and said, write your sister a letter. Thank you, God, for speaking to me. So I wrote her a letter, and I put it in the mailbox. And as the mailman was taking it away, I called my sponsor. And I said, guess what I just did? She said, what? I said, I just mailed my sister from hell a letter, an apology letter, an amends letter. And it just went off in the post. And she said, you, what? Don't ever do that again. And then she said, read the first line of the 9th step in the 12 and 12. And that is, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. Now, how about you? I don't have any of those things, and I need somebody to help me with those. And so about a week or so later, I get this letter back from my sister, and the first line was, I no longer associate with evil people. So I think maybe I should have read that letter to my sponsor before I mailed it off, right? So that's just kind of how my experience, you know. I tell you my experience so that maybe you won't make that mistake. But, you know, it's such an eye-opening journey to change how we are. The program cannot change who we are. You know, for me, who I am is, I was born in Memphis. I was the last child of 6. I had these parents and these, and I had this experience. And, that's who I am. But how I am is changeable. It is possible to do that and to find a way to live in society as a growing person, not acting like a sad, angry, lonely little girl. You know, that really explained to me why I was having so much trouble in society, why I was dressed up like an adult with all the trappings of an adult life, but interacting with people like a 4-year-old. And that's why people were having a hard time interacting with me. Have you ever interacted with a 4-year-old? I mean, it's difficult. It truly is. And oh God, take something away from one of them, then you're really in trouble. So every day I get to practice restraint of tongue and pen, and some pause, and some responding to life, and not reacting to life. And I have the ability to sometimes face fear without shaking my knees, and actually face fear with some faith that it's going to be okay. Get out of the results business. Stop trying to guess what's going to happen in the future, because I really don't know. You know, when I came into the program, I thought I was perfect. I really did. I thought I was perfect and everybody else was the problem. But one of the gifts that this program has given me is my imperfection. It is so relieving to be imperfect and to know that I don't have to be perfect, but it's not a bad thing to strive for. It talks about that in the 12 and 12 too. To set a, you know, do I really want to be what God wants me to be? And, you know, if I do, then I'm going to keep working these steps and I'm going to try to learn the lessons that are in each of them on a daily basis. And I want to read to you one of my favorite parts of the 12 and 12. It's in step 5. You know, a lot of old-timers, people pull out their that card about what are the principles behind the steps. If you're new, what you may not realize is that's really not part of AA. That's not written down anywhere in any of the steps. Now, some old-timers, again, I've been around a while, so the old-timers used to be mean as hell. I just tell you, some of them still are, but they would take you to mat over that. There are no principles behind the steps. But the 12 and 12 does say that the principle behind every step is humility. And each one of them really does do that. You know, when I came into this program, I thought the four hardest words that I would ever say were, I am an alcoholic. And I came in and found out the four hardest words for me to say are, will you help me? Okay? And you guys did, despite my bitter and nastiness. But here's a definition of humility that I think is very easy to swallow, and it's in the fifth step. It says, another great dividend we may expect from confiding our defects in another human being is humility, a word often misunderstood. To those who have made progress in AA, it, meaning humility, amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. So I'm going to just keep trying every day to be who I can be and deal with who I am in the best possible way. And I thank you guys. I hope it helps somebody get sober or stay sober today. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Yay!
We have asked Tammy to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey everybody, I'm Tammy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Great job, Julie. All right, so we're going to offer the white chip first. And it represents this kind of surrender. You'd like to join our way of life. What's your name? Derek. Welcome, Derek. I hope that you can stay sober one day at a time. All right. Anybody else for a white chip tonight? Then we have a 30-day chip. For 30 days of sobriety, it says, to thine own self be true. Red chip for 90 days. Then we have the yellow chip for 6 months. Anybody with 6 months? And then we have the green chip for 9 months. 9 months. And then we have a blue chip for any birthdays that we don't know about. Anybody have a AA birthday? Julie's going to give one out to her sponsee.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. And this is a sponsorship family right here, y'all. This is my sponsor. This is my sponsor. It's cool. I get the privilege of giving Amy her 4-year chip. And that was amazing. I said it earlier, when you say it's amazing you're getting 4 steps, it's kind of like it's an insult, isn't it? That's so amazing you're getting 4 years. But it is amazing. It's a miracle that we can go as low as we can go in this program or in life, and then come back to this place where Amy is in her life, and I will let her tell you about it.
My name's Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. This is 4. I definitely didn't think I'd ever get here. When I came back this last time, I was so beaten up, I didn't really care what I had to do. I just knew that I needed help. And I knew I couldn't do it by myself because that's what I've always tried. So thank y'all.
Do we have any reconsiderations on the white chip? Congratulations on the chips you rolled.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight.
Child.